Oh, all right. The Stack Overflow election is going to end before this podcast makes it up, so we won't even talk about it.
We can reveal the winner to be aired 2 weeks after everyone knows.
Okay, so far this is terrible.
We haven't started yet.
This might be the worst podcast.
We haven't started yet. Okay, now start it.
You're listening to Stack Exchange podcast number 45. I'm Joel Spolsky, your host, and today we have special guest Eric Lippert. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Joel. How's it going?
Very well, very well. Well, we'll introduce you in a minute, along with the usual David Fullerton.
Yep.
And Jay Henlon.
Good afternoon.
And producer Alex in the background.
Hola.
And yeah, Eric is a fairly famous contributor on Stack Overflow. He's written thousands of answers. Did I just make that up?
No, it's thousands. Well, it's over 1,000.
Let's go. Let's look. Let's look it up right now.
Eric Lippert has 2,232 answers.
Holy goodness.
On Stack Overflow.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, and 28 of them are still open. The rest have been closed. I'm not sure what you've been doing. But
you have not asked any questions, though, so you're not really pulling your weight there on the question asking.
He's asked questions on Meta, though, if I recall. Not a lot, but a couple.
And he's,
I think I've asked two on Meta.
Eric, I don't even, did you do anything before you worked at Microsoft? You were sort of famous for a lot of the languages at Microsoft, VBScript, JavaScript, and C Sharp.
That's right. I came to Microsoft right out of college. I went to the University of Waterloo, which has a cooperative education program.
Yep.
So before I was at Microsoft full-time, I was at Microsoft as an intern through that program. And then before that, I was at a company called Whatcom, which is in Waterloo.
Wait, do they make the Fortran compilers from 1963 or something?
Whoa.
They did.
Watt 4, Watt 5.
Yep, they made a they made a Fortran compiler, and they made a really high-quality C and C++ compiler. I worked on none of those. They also made a database product.
You weren't even alive, I hate to say it. Watt 4, which was in like 1961 probably, I'm just guessing here, was Waterloo Fortran, and then Watt 5 was Waterloo Fortran 4.
Correct. Right.
WAT was Waterloo, F is Fortran, and then IV is 4. So Watt 5 is Waterloo Fortran 4, which is Waterloo Fortran 4 was sort of a new version of Fortran that had all kinds of advanced features like floating point and stuff. You know, it was amazing. You could multiply as well as add.
Yes. They also had a version of BASIC called Waterloo BASIC that was available for the Commodore PET. And I actually had a Commodore PET with Waterloo BASIC on it when I was, good Lord, I must have been 11.
Wow.
Something like that.
Was the PET better than the Amiga, was it? What was the...
The PET? No. It was much earlier than the Amiga.
It was. Yeah. It was. I did have a PET and an Amiga at one point.
I always wanted a dog. Anyway.
It's too early to talk about Huskies. Keep going.
Okay.
So anyway, I worked at Whatcom, and I worked on a product called Whatcom SQL, which is a little database product, and it is now Sybase SQL Anywhere, I think, is what it's called now.
No kidding. That survived for a long time. That was sort of a way to get SQL. It was like synchronization, right? So it would like synchronize multiple SQL databases from point to point.
Yeah, there was some synchronization tool there. This was all when I was very young, and I don't remember the details now.
I want to say that it allows you to do things like run SQL on like mobile phones and stuff like that, but that's just impossible because they didn't even have phones at the time.
On beepers.
Alphanumeric pagers.
No idea what I was thinking of. But I think actually in those days, that like when SQL Anywhere got started, like laptops weren't really full-powered machines, and so having SQL that could run on DOS or something was sort of a major advancement.
Okay, so this is all a long time ago, but more recently, much more recently, been at Microsoft.
You've been at Microsoft, and you worked on VB, which I worked on.
That's right.
You worked on VB Script.
Did you guys know each other?
I arrived after Joel left.
You see, even after my time.
We've allocated 20 minutes for you guys asking if you respectively know someone that the other person worked with.
Oh, yeah. So you know him.
How far up the org chart do you have to go?
Well, I never saw any of Eric's check-ins, but he probably saw some of mine. So there.
That's probably the case. I started working on VB as an intern in 94.
Okay, that's right, when I was leaving.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I worked on, I was on the Excel team, so I don't really count, but we were putting VB into Excel, and I like to take credit for persuading the VB team to add for each, which was the enumeration construct. What else did I convince them to add?
The with statement. Yeah.
And the whole iDispatch thing, because we needed variants. We needed, what became the variant data type so that things could change the type of things that they held. Otherwise, you could not fetch a value out of a cell on a spreadsheet and store it in a variable in Visual Basic. because it could be a number or a string.
Right. So you were working with like Doug Franklin and Andrew Solomon and those guys on that, I think.
I guess.
Yeah.
One forgets. I just sort of would send over memos saying we need this or we. It was fun in those days because it's like the Excel team demand. It was like Joel Spolsky who was
memos.
Like, I was like,
these are actual
20.
Printed memos, no. And you gave it to a page to run it over to the other building.
I'm guessing it was email, but I'm also guessing that Microsoft in those days had a different word for email because they had a different word for everything. So, no, it was email. Now you made me forget my whole train of thought. Mm. It was strange because I would send over a thing saying, hey, you should have for each. That was for each was taken from C Shell, which was the first place I had seen it on Unix, where you could do something to every file in a directory. Using the syntax for each. I don't think Pascal had for each. No, Pascal had with. And I wanted with because you were constantly having to do the same thing to do multiple things to the same object.
Excel's that program where I can make a calendar for myself,
oh,
right?
Oh, dear. No, it's a...
Sorry, it's like a database.
Ah, yeah. Oh, I see the connection. So you could use that SQL thing that Joel was talking about earlier to find stuff in the database in Excel.
Have we started the podcast yet?
I really hope not.
Welcome!
And then, Eric, you went to work on VBScript.
When I started full-time at Microsoft, I worked on VBScript and JScript for many years.
Wow. VBScript has, in my mind, the worst feature of that. Like, well, all right, let's do this. Let's play this game. What is the worst feature in VBScript?
Oh, good heavens. Well, I could name you know, any number of ways that the VBScript differs in subtle ways from Visual Basic. That was confusing.
Yeah.
But if I had to name a worst feature, the fact that calling COM objects and passing byref variables can leak memory, that was a bad one.
Wait a minute, I didn't even know that. That's not even a feature. Passing byref, okay.
Yeah.
I'll tell you mine. This is
my favorite one.
Let's... My favorite one, and I know this because I had to write a VBScript compiler. I didn't really have to. I merely had to instruct various summer interns to write VBScript compilers at Frog Creek. My favorite is that if you put an A less than and then a number and then a right then. So you've got some A left banana, one right banana. So A sub one could mean any of, I think, about 10 different things.
Oh, yeah.
It could either mean call the function named A, passing the value one. It could mean there is an array called A and retrieve its first element or its second element, either of those.
Yes.
It could mean that A is an object, call its default method, passing the value 1, right?
Oh, yeah.
It could mean A is an object, call its default method, which returns an array, and then look up the first element of that array.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm missing probably 9 different things that could mean. And it was a combination of the fact that you used parentheses for both function calls and subscripts, and the fact that at some point somebody, I think me, decided that it was a really good idea if you should have a default property on everything. If you did not actually specify what property you wanted, but merely mentioned the object, then it would look up the default property. And then the fact that you've got properties and methods, and they're all sort of mixed up. So that became something that only at runtime could you figure out anything even remotely like what that meant.
Right. And that was a vexing feature. I totally agree with you. But it sort of comes out of one of the design principles of Visual Basic and hence VBScript, which was, you know, even if the theory is not really that well-founded, you know, of, mm-hmm. you know, sort of programming language theory, try to figure out what the user meant, right? And try to do the right thing. VB programmers and VBScript programmers tend to view the compiler as the thing that's in their way, not the thing that's helping them.
Yeah.
Right. And so you want to have the language, like, try to sort of fail to the mode of doing what's usually the right
something.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, those rules that you describe, I had to write the IntelliSense engine for those rules.
Yeah.
And you should see the comments that I left in the code there, you know, explaining all of the different paths that, you know, whereby you could say, okay, well, somebody has just hit a paren, right?
Right.
What could this mean, right? What do we have to display now?
That seems almost impossible. Yeah.
Yes. And the case that you missed was parens are used in a method call to indicate that a variable should be passed by value, not by reference.
Oh, I thought that was just an accident of the fact that when you wrapped something in parens, you caused it to be evaluated.
It is an accident, but it's an accident that people take advantage of and ended up being documented.
There was also the subtle difference between Oh, yeah. That subs and functions are different things. So A sub 1 or A left paren 1, right paren, could either be calling the sub A passing 1 as a value or calling the function A with 1 as an argument. They're actually different things.
They are.
Oh,
they
actually, are. Let me give you a case where it's different. So if you say A sub B, all right, I'm using the old basic programmer's system of using sub to mean left paren. A left paren, B right paren could either mean evaluate B and then pass it by value to the subroutine A, or it could mean call the function A passing B by reference.
Right, and it was very confusing which was which. And I, actually, that was one of the very first blog articles I wrote. Was about the error message, cannot use parentheses when calling a sub, right? People would ask me all the time.
I had that yesterday.
What does that error message mean? And I would tell them it means you can't use parentheses when calling a sub, right? Like,
this is totally taking me back to the bad old days.
But what you had to do is you had to stick the word call there and that would fix it, right?
Yes. Yes. So well,
if you call the sub with the word call.
Oh yeah. My goodness.
So while we're on the subject of stuff that is messed up in VBScript, a couple more things have come to mind. Soft types. If you have a comparison between two variables, it's between two variants, right? Mm-hmm. Then the comparison semantics are different if it's two variables than if it's a variable and a string, or a variable and a numeric literal.
That
right?
surprises me.
It is surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I thought I knew this language. Wow.
Yeah, no, VBScript does not, and you know, more generally VB, does not obey the sort of design principle of late-bound languages, which is that the late-bound version does what the early-bound version would have done had you known the type information at early binding time.
No, because the late-bound is it's just doing that by having a type, which is a variant type, so it is actually bound. It's just. Everything's bound to a variant in VBScript.
Yeah. And one more thing, that's messed up in early versions of VB and VBScript is the fact that assigning a reference requires a set keyword.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that. No, but didn't somebody remove that at some point?
Yeah, that was removed from VB,
VB.net. VB.net, which is almost even worse.
And from Wasabi.
And Wasabi, we took that out of our variant of VBScript that we wrote here.
Oh my goodness. These I are, forgot. Something... You wrote, it was
yeah.
dim object colon set, set object
you
equal.
You always have to say dim a colon set a equals
yeah.
new.
And colon
whatever.
Was just your way to put two statements on one line.
Right. Ugh. Right. Yeah.
I forgot. I deliberately forgot all of this, I think. this is my brain protecting me from the past. We have one other suggestion for worst VB feature from our chat room, which is on error resume next.
Oh, on error, big pain in the ass, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So for our non-programmer listeners, that one says, if something blows up, just keep going.
Yeah.
Don't just ignore it and keep going.
It's okay. I know that this happens.
The non-programmer listeners have already tuned out.
this is like the DVD director's commentator for VB. Yeah. This is
special.
So here's a more philosophical question, Eric. It seems to me like some of the most popular languages in the world historically have been, over time, I mean, languages like PHP, VBScript, VB, Java's an exception, but I want to say that the most popular languages of all time, and JavaScript right now, were the ones that were designed in a rush and which have major design flaws that you kind of wish you could have gone back and fixed, but then you can't because of backwards compatibility.
Yeah, I have very frequently noticed this, and it's kind of one of these worse is better things, right? Yeah. Where you get something out that works, and it's kind of been designed on a rainy weekend in Seattle, but it's out there, and people start using it, and then you end up with this situation where you can't go back and fix the problems because now people are depending on it.
Right. Like, I believe the history of VBScript is that there was sort of a political rush to come up with another language to match JavaScript that would presumably be more familiar to the VB programmers. And so it was just an attempt to strip out things from Visual Basic.
Like, oh, yeah.
Like types.
Yeah. And literally a couple of guys worked on it over a rainy weekend in Seattle.
Yeah.
And they came up with something that, worked pretty well.
And rather than saying, let's make a dynamic language, they just said, let's eliminate all data types except for variant.
Right.
Without realizing the implications of that or possibly realizing them. PHP, I think, is the worst one because I think one of the things I noticed about PHP, if you look closely, the designers of the language did not understand why there was a set keyword in Visual Basic.
Right.
They just didn't get why you needed such a thing. And therefore, they created all kinds of problems for themselves with reference versus value semantics that have persisted to this day to be confusing and annoying features of PHP.
Right.
And the reason that set was there is because of default values. I've already starting to forget why now.
Yeah.
You have to know whether something is an object or whether or not you want to retrieve the default value of the object, whether something's an object or a value. You have to have some clue from the programmer whether this thing is an object that you want to treat as a reference to the object or whether this thing is a value type and you want to retrieve the default value.
Right. Yeah. And you compare that to say JavaScript, which certainly has its flaws. You know, I can point out flaws in JavaScript, you know, all day if you want. But it is much more sort of a theoretically well-founded language.
Possibly. It was also rushed out though. There.
Oh, it was. It was. Yeah. But at least, you know, people who were working on it, like Brendan and Walter Moore Horwat and those guys, did have a pretty strong understanding of, you know, of programming languages and what makes a well-designed programming language.
Right.
Waldemar once told me that he viewed JavaScript as common Lisp with the syntax of Java.
Yeah. The syntax for Java was the second stage. The first step, it looked a lot more like Scheme, I think.
Yeah.
This was before it ever shipped. But then there was some kind of a deal between Netscape and Sun, and it became a political imperative to make it look a little bit like Java, sort of, so it could be called Java, even though it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the questions that I got most frequently when I was, answering before Stack Overflow came along, when I was answering questions on, you know, comp-lang Java or whatever, or comp-lang JavaScript, you know, was what's the relationship between Java and JavaScript? And the answer is, well, there's a marketing relationship between them. You know, they'll tell you, oh, well, we called it JavaScript because you can script your Java programs. Who out there uses JavaScript to script Java programs?
I don't know if you even could then, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very strange thing to claim.
It seems like a marketing campaign that was sort of invented by marketing people that didn't really... I mean, it serves no marketing purpose.
Right.
So, Eric, as you talk about switching to Stack Overflow, let's get in the mind of Eric Lippert. We talk a lot...
I don't think I can handle it.
I don't know what David's envisioning. But we talk a lot... I think we've talked on the podcast before. As soon as you try to explain what we do to anybody, to my relatives, et cetera, it always ends the same way with some question of... whether we are answering questions all day and how I got competent in answering programmers' questions, or who we pay, what team of underage children somewhere we pay to sit at computers and answer programming questions. And as you walk through it, they get increasingly more confused. You go, no, we don't give them money or we don't do it ourselves. People just do it and we give them points. And then we get into this, well, how do they trade in their points? Is it like skee-ball? Is there a list? And what do you do with these points? You go, no, the points allow you to do more on the site. You can actually go and like edit other people's questions and clean things up, and you get more power from these points. And they go, oh, so you give them fake points they can use to work more for you for what? And over time, they don't understand at all. But what I'm sort of interested in is I'm intrigued to hear what got you started participating, not reading as much as participating initially, and what brings you back today. I have a theory on what drives people, but I won't give it away yet. When you first started answering questions, say, what made you want to do it? I mean, people go to look all the time, but what made you want to start giving people answers?
That's a good question. So first off, to address your thing about the points, you know, it's like whose line is it anyway, right? Everything's made up and the points don't matter.
Exactly.
What brought me to Stack Overflow in the beginning was something that one of my very early managers at Microsoft told me, which was, you know, he said to me, I want you to be a recognized industry expert on something, right? And since we work on the JavaScript team at Microsoft, that would probably be a good thing, right? But don't pick something that's too big, right? Like, don't try to be the recognized industry expert on, you know, the whole thing, right? Pick some aspect of it, like, you know, the semantics of the language. And so I was like, okay, well, how do I do that? And he said, find a source of questions, answer every question you know the answer to that's in that domain. And if there's a question in that domain that you don't know the answer to, make it your business to find out. And that attitude has served me extremely well.
Cool. Who is that? Who is that manager?
His name was Chris Waite, and he is not at Microsoft anymore, I don't think. I run into him every now and then. You know, Seattle's a small town. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen him for a few years.
But that's kind of cool. Long before we had a careers product, right? And part of that is sort of a place where we try to encourage programmers to show off what they've kind of shared and what they know for their, you know, for getting jobs, et cetera. Your manager sort of saw, not us, but as this notion, this kind of thing, as what you ought to be doing is finding a place where you can establish credibility as an expert in this field.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, and a great way to do that is to answer people's questions. And the wonderful side effect of that is every time there was a question that I didn't know the answer to, I made it my business to find out, and pretty soon I was an expert.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. And that raises an interesting sort of follow-up, because I think it's you no longer, I think, are struggling to try and convince people that you are, say, a valid expert in C# or these other topics. There seems to be a fairly general consensus that that's the case. What makes you, I mean, you continue to be a really active participant. What brings you back to do it today?
Well, I'm no longer at Microsoft, but while I was at Microsoft, there were kind of three things. One, you know, continuing that process of becoming an expert. Two, Microsoft at the time was very, very much encouraging everybody to have meaningful, real customer interactions, you know, on an ongoing basis. And so that was a great way to do that.
That was the generation of the MSDN blogs, I think, that were highly encouraged.
Right.
Kind of every single, like literally everyone at Microsoft had a blog on MSDN blogs.
Right. There were tens of thousands of blogs, and many of them only had two or three posts in them.
Yeah. But some of them were great. I mean, I learned a lot.
Some of them were absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
And continue to be fabulous today. So, yeah. So there was the fact that I was being encouraged to do that kind of work and be paid for it. And the third thing was, it's excellent customer research, right? Every time somebody asks a question on Stack Overflow about C#, it's because that's a smart person who is confused by some aspect of programming, you know, some aspect of using a tool that I'm making to try to make their lives better. Right? And if they're being confused by it, then there's an opportunity there for them to be educated and for me to realize how it was that I failed to design a tool that was easy to use. So I no longer work at Microsoft. So a couple of those reasons have fallen at, you know, off the radar there. But I enjoy it. I enjoy hearing people's questions. And I now work for a company that does static analysis of source code, looking for people's bugs.
Coverity.
For Coverity.
Yep.
Yes. And
tell the people what static analysis is.
So static analysis.
The static keyword is used for all kinds of crap in programming languages these days. It means everything. Yeah.
So what I mean by static analysis is the kind of analysis that a really good compiler does.
Mm.
So the compiler takes in the source code, and it first of all figures out, is this even a legal piece of text? Is it actually a legal C# program?
Right.
Right. And if it is, then it generates object code at the back end, or IL, or whatever it does, right? It translates it into some kind of other language. But on the way, good compilers also produce warnings as they go and say, well, hey, you know, it looks like you might be using some idiom of the language in some not quite correct way here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea of static analysis, is that you do the analysis based solely on the source code and the metadata that you have in front of you.
So it's one of the points is it's not at runtime, it's at compile time. It just looks at
exactly.
The source code. And among other things, that means that it doesn't know things like whether a left paren 1 right paren is a function call or a array lookup or all it knows is what can be determined at compile time.
Right. So this is an important characteristic of languages, and something that language designers think about very, very hard, we hope, is what features of the language are amenable to static analysis and which ones are not.
Right. I don't think language designers ever think about that, but thanks for giving them credit.
we hope that they do.
I think possibly the designers of Haskell thought about that, but no other language.
Yeah. So, well, it's certainly something we thought about very carefully for C#.
Okay, you know. That's fair.
So anyway, that's the idea of static analysis, and Coverity makes tools that do static analysis of C, C++, Java, and C#, and they do a much, much deeper static analysis than compilers do, and they have a sort of a heuristic engine that looks at all of the code paths and tries to figure out if there are code paths that contain bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the great things about Stack Overflow is it is a rich source of buggy code.
No, thanks. So,
mission accomplished.
Yeah. And so while looking at people's questions, you know, something that is, you know, always in the sort of forefront of my mind now is if somebody has a program that doesn't work the way they think it should, and they've asked about it on Stack Overflow, could I write a heuristic that would say, hey, this program doesn't do what you think it does.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. And then show them the Stack Overflow question that answers their, their problem.
That has crossed my mind a number of times, right? Huh. Because in all seriousness, one of the great difficulties of writing static analyzers is how do you present the defect to the developer in a way that they can understand it,
yeah,
right? Because some of these defects involve, you know, sort of tortuous paths through the code that you would not expect to take, but when you do take them, they end up dereferencing null or whatever, some such thing.
Right.
And particularly the ones that involve concurrency are quite difficult, yes, to explain. So if there was some way to say, hey, you should just go to this Stack Overflow question about this guy who had the same problem as you, that would be great. But
you could detect somebody trying to use regular expressions to parse HTML.
Hmm. For example,
that should be possible.
Or somebody trying to program on a boat.
I know, but the first one is a fail.
Yeah, in all seriousness, you can detect people who are trying to sanitize inputs to strip the HTML out of them, right?
Yeah.
And then you can say, know what? Looks like either maybe A, you haven't done a good job of sanitizing this HTML, or B, that's evidence that maybe we should be looking at this code path for cross-site scripting or for SQL injection or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So your initial reasoning for kind of getting active does not meet my unified theory of why people would do it. The general answer I actually give people at the end is I say, well, almost everyone, programmers, I think even more so, but almost everyone you know either genuinely likes to help people or likes to show off how smart they are. And many people like both. And that they
both those things are true of me.
No, I know, but you actually had this strategic. Yours falls somewhere between like I genuinely wanted to learn and my boss made me, which is a whole different. And what I would say is people get started that way, right? Someone doesn't know something or said something wrong and they can correct it and show off how much they know and kind of demonstrate their skill, or they just really like to feel like they did something for someone. And then what I say is the system that the points don't matter system, and the fact that it opens up something, even though something you wouldn't think is a value, what it does is it reinforces. So if you like to feel like you were smart or you like to help people, the difference is you can keep going back and you can keep seeing a number increment that says another person said you were helpful, right? Or another person said you're really, really smart. And that the system really gives you this tangible feedback on a thing you sort of already cared about. It wouldn't work by itself if you didn't care, but its meaninglessness doesn't interfere with its ability to measure something you're interested in. But so my question today is, so, and you just crossed 200,000 not long ago, so do you know offhand roughly what your Stack Overflow score is? Do you go back and see how many upvotes you got, or do you pay less attention to that now?
I pay almost no attention to the raw score. I noticed that I got over 200,000 points when you guys sent me a sweater. It was great. Thanks. I wear it all the time. I do keep a fairly close eye on, you know, were the answers that I wrote actually helpful? Mm-hmm. One, like you say, it's just gratifying to know that you've helped somebody. And two, you get a sense about what problems are important to people when you see which ones get a lot of attention and which ones don't.
Yeah.
So we have some listener questions.
We have listener questions. The listeners are not actually listening.
We tweeted out earlier today questions for Eric Lippert that we're having him on the podcast. Tweet your questions. So some interesting ones. Almost all of them, I mean, not terribly surprisingly, they're almost all about C#, which, you know, you don't really work on the compiler anymore, but or the language anymore. But and you've probably heard some of these. So the first question is, if you could change one thing in C# and have a genie fix up all existing code, what would you change?
Do I just get one?
Well, we can give you two.
I can think of half a dozen without without taxing well, my mind over.
You're gone from Microsoft a few weeks. You're already tearing up C#, man. I don't know.
Oh, no. So every year there is a conference that is, you know, at the conference center in downtown Seattle that is only for Microsoft employees. And what happens is all of the field workers, right, the people who are technical evangelists and, you know, salespeople and whatnot, come in and they get briefed by the, you know, research and development teams about what's coming next. And they get to talk to the team and ask questions and whatnot. It's super fun. And every year that the C# team does that, somebody asks, if you could fix one thing in the C-sharp language without consequences, what would you fix? So I've heard this question many, many times.
We didn't promise they'd be original questions.
So. Yeah. So that's why it's so easy to tear it apart, right? They're all small things, but they're all really irksome. So, you know, one that kind of my worst pet peeve is unsafe array covariance, which is kind of a highfalutin, you know, category theory word. But basically, if you have an array of turtles, mm-hmm. you can cast that thing to an array of animals, right? And then you can put a giraffe into it. Mm-hmm. And at runtime, it says, hey, you thought that was an array of animals. You thought you could put a giraffe into it, but it's actually an array of turtles, and we're going to crash. Mm. So it's a place where the static analysis of the language fails, right? Because you should be able to statically determine, you know, that this value is not assignment compatible with this variable. This you know, array locations are variables. They vary. And even worse, it means that every time you insert an element into an array that is of a non-sealed reference type, the runtime has to do a check to see,
right,
is this array actually of the type that it says it is? Right? So it makes all array accesses slightly slower.
Yeah.
So that this one crazy feature that hardly anybody uses will work.
I don't even program about giraffes or turtles. I've never had a giraffe or a turtle.
Well, it also applies to dogs and cats, you see.
Right.
I think one of your most popular questions on Stack Overflow is about a turtle.
That's actually true.
Smart guy. That's true. That's a logo turtle, though.
Okay, so that's your number one. What's your number two?
What's my number two? Oh, good Lord. There are so many to choose from.
This is where it gets interesting.
The fact that nullability and non-nullability was not baked into the type system from the beginning.
Yeah, that was a bad thing to add later. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the type system began with nullable reference types and non-nullable value types. And then nullable value types were added.
Right.
Non-nullable reference types will probably never be added. It's too late now.
Non-nullable reference types. Meaning a reference that always has to be assigned to something.
Right, so that you say, oh, this is a non-nullable string, and you are guaranteed that a variable of type non-nullable string always has a string in it.
There's always some string there, yeah.
And that's the real problem, is you want your type system to provide an ironclad guarantee.
The reason this always bugged me is that there's like that impedance mismatch between databases and the language that always generated a lot of extra code.
Right.
So every time you pull something from a database, there's 10 lines in there instead of just kind of an assignment sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. While you go through and fix up the slightly different way that the database is storing things and that your language is storing things.
Right. And nullability is a big part of that because, of course, you know, databases have this notion that data can be null.
Yeah.
So, that's my lesson to you all is the next time you design a type system, mm-hmm. design it with nullability and non-nullability baked into it as key concepts from the beginning.
Hmm. Got it. I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah.
That's tip number two from Eric. Number one was the thing about being an expert in your field or something. That seems less important, though.
Next user question is, if you were an ice cream cone, what's the worst thing you ever saw Bill Gates do? It's possible I misread it, but I still think it's a valid question.
When you work at Microsoft, people ask you three questions, or at least they used to when I started.
Have you ever met Bill Gates?
Yes. Are you a millionaire?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever met Bill Gates? And can you fix my computer?
And you've only been out of the company for a short time, but the can you fix my computer one takes a long time.
That's actually why we had you on the podcast.
Yeah. We've got an issue that actually, we talked to Clippy, we restarted, neither worked, but now you're here.
And
we have high hopes.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the strange things about working at Microsoft on languages, because I have worked essentially only on languages. I worked briefly on Visual Studio Tools for Office, but mm-hmm. I worked on the plumbing side of it, which had to solve a lot of the same problems that you solve in compilers. And as a result, I have never written a Windows program. You know, all of the programs that I write, text goes in and bytecode goes out the other end, right? The only Windows functions I ever call are open this file, and that's it.
But surely you call create file, you do using the Windows API function, not in just open.
No, this is Eric Lippert you're talking to. Come on, he doesn't use the API.
You don't have to use the Windows 32 API.
He just
doesn't have to call create. Yeah.
But the number of times that I have needed to make a message loop, a Windows message loop in one of my programs, professionally, I could probably count on the fingers of one hand. So I know very, very little about Windows programming or maintenance of Windows machines. You know, I am no better at hooking up my wireless network than my mom.
That's interesting because there's actually
who's not a technical
person.
This
is sort of another impedance mismatches between the needs of event-driven user interface programming and the languages that are provided for them. So there was always some funny thing going on. I mean, to take an old school example, Visual Basic would map events to, like operating system events, like the mouse has just moved down to particular function calls by using a syntactic notation where it was, the name of the object and then an underscore and then the name of the event. And that was actually hidden from you by the editor. So it just sort of looked like there was just sort of this mismatch between what the language facilities provided and what you needed to do event-driven programming.
Yeah, and we preserved that in VBScript, right? And actually made it a requirement, that you name your event handlers using that naming scheme.
Yeah.
And in fact, little known fact, I added a syntax to JavaScript to do the same thing so that you could hook up VB style events in JavaScript.
Which is actually kind of going backwards because there's sort of the Visual Basic idea was, look, we'll just say that underscore blah, blah means whatever. And then I think in Java and in C sharp, there was sort of a tendency to say, oh, you can actually hook up any method that you want to handle your events. So you kind of have to go through and hook them up.
Right.
And then there was sort of a trend to go backwards. And I think Ruby on Rails specifically was sort of the first place you saw this more reactionary trend of saying, let's just have a convention. You know, it's okay if you have to name your function a certain way for it to handle a certain event. There's no need to have the flexibility of being able to hook up any arbitrary function to any arbitrary event. That just creates all this maintenance scaffolding code.
Right.
So let me ask a question about you. You made a big switch recently, I should say. I'm intrigued a little bit by what you found that you sort of like best and have found most frustrating going from, I'd say, a big company to a smaller company. I just made a similar switch recently, and it's the scale makes a bigger difference almost than I think any other change.
That is certainly true. You know, Coverity is a much smaller company, obviously, than Microsoft, which is behemoth.
How many employees at Coverity?
It changes from day to day because they are hiring so quickly right now, but it's on the order of 250.
That's a little bit smaller than Microsoft.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like 90,000, 100,000. Yeah. So, it is certainly the case that it's different working at a smaller company. I can walk into the vice president's office anytime I want. Well, aside from the fact that he's in San Francisco and I'm in Seattle, but
it's a long walk. That's what it comes down to. But you could
a bike would be better.
But yeah, the organization is much smaller and flatter, and you can very quickly get to know everybody in it. Whereas, at Microsoft, one of the things that that I noticed after having worked at Microsoft for many, many years was I was actually knowing fewer and fewer people as time went on and not more and more because there were just so many new people in the division. Old people were leaving. Yeah. And I feel like here, I can have a big impact on the future of the company. Right.
Yeah.
At Microsoft, I could have a big impact on the future of the C# language, which is great. I'm certainly not denigrating that in any way.
Yeah.
But it feels different working for a smaller company and knowing that all of the work that you do directly impacts the bottom line in a pretty clear way.
Yeah.
So that's pretty nice. One of the things that I was a bit surprised about changing companies was not so much going from a large company to a small company, but from going from a company that is, for obvious reasons, steeped in sort of the Windows development, all the mechanisms of Windows development, you know, Visual Studio and C Sharp and Visual Basic and all of those, to a company that came out of static analysis of C code largely targeted towards the embedded systems market, right? Mm-hmm. So the C code that runs on, you know, microwaves or the Mars lander or, you know, whatever, right?
Joel's
the stuff
beeper.
That is, yeah, or beepers, huh? Yes, those stuff
beeper.
Like that, right? Where beeper. The code really has to be correct because it's very expensive to ship a patch,
right?
And so that was Coverity's initial sort of core market. And so they come out of a world that is very much, you know, sort of the more traditional Unix development. Mm-hmm. And I have not worked on, you know, developing Unix software since I was a student at Waterloo. And I was a little surprised to discover that it really has not changed much since then.
I know. Yeah. I know. You still run Emacs. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I've started using Vi again.
Yeah.
And, you know, fortunately, it's all still in my fingers.
It's fun. But, you know, one thing I often compare it to is that the Microsoft world, where the development tools are generally paid for and there's sort of corporations that are involved, everything's a little bit more luxurious. So it sort of feels like, I don't know, it feels like business class travel, or it feels like having a Buick, right? Where there's a you know, electric windows and there's like all kinds of seat warmers and that kind of stuff. And that's the Visual Studio experience. And then you go off into sort of Unix world and there are heat warmers, but you have to buy them separately and stick them under your seat, and they work better. But sometimes they burn you because they work so well. Sometimes they, you know what I mean? Like, they don't have, there's just all these like little luxuries that you sort of imagine you associate with like a Lexus or a Buick, like that kind of car, a Cadillac, but you can't feel the road. And then kind of get back into the Unix world and everything's a Jeep Wrangler and it's four-wheel drive and there's all kinds of third-party add-ons and things you build for yourself and stuff you solder for yourself onto the car, and it's all ugly as crap.
Yeah. And if something goes wrong, open up the hood.
Yeah, yeah. If something goes wrong, your neck gets cut off the first time, and the second time, your neck gets cut off. Your neck gets cut off again. And on the other hand, you're kind of working with power tools, so it's a little bit more. It's just a very different.
Which is why your neck keeps getting cut off.
Yeah,
Joel. Right. That's why Joel's not allowed around power tools.
Power tools, yeah. Exactly. But we're sort of running out of time in the podcast, but David, you had mentioned that you have some stuff. I want to steer the podcast a little bit towards the subject of...
We had one quick announcement,
news. Okay,
which was just we have a new site. That's not. It's been in public beta for a couple weeks now, but
okay.
It's Sustainable Living.
What?
Yeah.
Do I have to type that into the URL bar?
I think it's sustainability.
Sustainability.stackexchange.com.
Okay. Look at that. Are electric cars as environmentally friendly as we think they are? Okay. When do you know you're generating too much waste? That doesn't seem like it has a good answer. All right. I'm already worried about this site. How can I be more energy efficient in an apartment? That's a... all right. Can we close this site down before we... before we do the podcast? Was that our only announcement?
No, we cannot. let's start with the answer to that question.
For those of you on the sustainability site, get in there and ask some real questions. Here's a good one. Would monocrystalline or polycrystalline solar panels perform best in the UK climate? There you go. That's it. That sounds like a real question.
Yeah, and I think you glossed over the apartment one, I think, too quickly. I actually think that's a decent question, because what they're getting at is a lot of the kind of headline things that people do to make more sustainable, greener homes require you to own them, right? Installing solar panels, et cetera.
You have to like live in a suburb and drive to work every day before you even have an opportunity to save emissions on by not driving to work.
Right, that they're the things that most people are focused on in getting more energy efficient don't apply, right? Solar panels, changing car types, et cetera, don't apply when you live in a tiny apartment in New York City. What are the things you can do to change your footprint? I think there's actually some pretty solid answers there. I thought that was a pretty good question.
Okay.
People gave kind of good bullet point check off list. I think the site's off, I'd say, to a slow start. There's definitely, I think they're getting some good quality questions. They've got an engaged community. Probably not as much, the activity's not continuing to grow at a pace we'd like to see. There's always a little bit of a drop off, I think, after the initial surge. Mm-hmm. But we'd certainly like to see more people in there. And,
so if you're listening to this podcast, get in there on sustainability.stackexchange.com and ask us your questions about electric cars in apartments.
And don't forget to recycle, or in New York, you'll get arrested.
Mm. Okay.
And then actually, so this site kind of leads us into one interesting meta question that we wanted to look at. So this is meta question 1665666.
On the site or on
Meta Stack Overflow. /Q/166566, which is kind of a, it's not a...
We forgot the hat tip. We're doing hat tips now, right? The question was asked.
Mark Mayo.
There we go.
His last name is a condiment.
His first name is too in some countries. Okay, anyway.
So he's not coming from the perspective of Stack Overflow, coming from the perspective of some of these smaller sites where somebody asks a good question and it gets what he describes as not always useful but well-intentioned answers by somebody who, in his example,
right,
they don't really know the answer to the question, but they, you know, they had a brother-in-law who once did something similar, and it might be related.
This is
the Yahoo Answers. Yahoo Answers. I heard about this once, and it made me
sad. Well, this is what you're supposed to do in real life, right? So, if the three of us were standing around at a bar without access to the Book of Knowledge on a smartphone, and one of us said,
"What bar are we at?"
We are at Industry.
Cool. I don't know what that is, but that sounds cool. I bet I couldn't even get in there. I like it.
No, you'd get in.
Okay.
52nd and 52nd between 8th and 9th in New York City.
You don't know what kind of bar I want to go to, Producer Alex.
I know you don't want to go to that one.
Very, very quick to presume.
That is a fine.
Okay, so we're in a bar. You and Jay. Yeah. And me and Eric.
Right. And we're talking about, let's say, for example, a problem that I'm facing today. I want to bring over a summer intern from Portugal, and I don't know what kind of visa he's going to need and whether he's going to be able to get one. So we don't have smartphones because actually you don't get very good reception on Verizon in that bar. So, true. And
that's why Alex thinks I won't like it there, is I like to have reception all the time and they don't have good reception.
Yeah, you have a Verizon phone.
Exactly. Yeah,
right. And so you say, you know, I don't know that, but when I was in Brazil, I had a visa that was just a tourist visa that I had to apply for on the internet. And I say, that's interesting. So you've carried forth a conversation. You've done something that's a sort of totally social thing. This is a social thing to do, right? Like, you have to say something. You can't just say, I know, no idea.
Say something you believe to be true that is as related as is possible to what's being talked about, which may not be terribly related.
Right, right. Or you could say something like, hey, I wonder if there's a Portuguese embassy in New York. Maybe they can answer that question. When really the answer is you need to go to the American embassy in Lisbon to find out the answer to that. But okay, either way, it's not an answer.
Right.
So people will do that. They won't do that on Stack Overflow. It's too many questions, too much volume. They're not going to answer with just kind of random, like, well, I don't know, but my cousin might know.
Right. Well, this happens on a site where a question's sat unanswered for a few days, and then somebody feels bad, and they're like, well, I'll give you the best I've got.
And there's two or three people that are on that site who are like, I really got to make this site work. I'm going to do everything I can to try to answer some questions.
And this is actually, it's because this is really endemic of the sort of what you tend to get on those sites where there is no vertical, right? So we talk about Yahoo Answers and stuff, but the fundamental issue is
it's all you get on Yahoo Answers.
Right, there's people who are hanging out there who are interested in interacting and actually want to be useful.
They answer everything.
But they're there to talk about prom, and you're there to talk about auto mechanics and auto mechanicry.
Mechanisms.
And so when you ask your auto car, they go, I don't know, but my daddy has a car and he drives it everywhere and I'm hoping he'll take me to prom. Do you have any thoughts on what I should wear? Even if you don't, I hope you solve your problem. They get a lot of hope you solve your problem.
Your daddy's taking you to prom?
Is that not what people do?
Driving you off.
Wow. No.
That got weird fast.
He's facilitating the transportation to and from the event.
That's not, industry is not that kind
of
car.
Let's circle back.
So the question is not, obviously we recognize this is not a good answer, right? That's the premise of the question. The question is, what should we do about it?
Have we talked about this?
The first problem is you certainly shouldn't accept those not so good answers. That's one thing that happens is there's everything about our system is encouraging you to hit the little checkbox and accept the answers, but you probably shouldn't.
Right. In fact, I think accepting should have the highest bar. Like, I will sometimes ask a question and someone will give a kludgy workaround and I'll upvote it if it's the only answer. I'll say that helps, but it's really, I really wanted something more native.
This is a great place to
use
comments.
But I won't accept. Accepting, I require usually that it really solves the problem in a manner that appears to be a good, clean one. But even upvoting here is probably not right? They're trying to help, but it actually is not very helpful. Do we use a specific example or we only use my dumb, extreme, exaggerated example?
We can use a specific example.
Sure, go ahead.
So what's the example he used? It was a travel question, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I thought you had an example.
No, there was an example in the question, no?
Something about a visa thing.
Mark Mayo's question. Oh, that was the Portuguese visa. The Portuguese visa.
Yeah.
But he just made up an example. It's not a real example.
No, I think there really was an example like that, actually. Travel.stackexchange is full of that. Because what will happen is that somebody will ask a perfectly legit question that does have an answer, about a bus from point A to point B, and just really nobody knows. And we just don't have enough volume to answer those.
So let me say what I've been doing, and I'm not sure it's the right answer. So my general...
What is the easiest way to go from Puno to La Paz through Lake Titicaca?
Wanted to say Lake Titicaca. You tried not to laugh out loud, but you have a sheet of paper in front of you. You have a notepad that says nothing but work in Lake Titicaca. That was your whole plan for this podcast, and there's nothing else on it.
That's not true. But what is true is there's a picture open on a desktop that is a funny picture of huskies falling over that says, I forgot how to dog.
Yeah, we should put that in the show notes.
So back to the question, what should you do?
So I have to say, historically, and I think this is wrong, I hadn't thought of it, but I was just a regular old civilian user. If I saw someone who was trying to help and gave a sort of related answer that wasn't factually incorrect, but wasn't really helpful in any meaningful way, and it was the only answer historically, I would ignore it. What I would do is actually, if I saw an answer like that,
it doesn't even answer the question, but it's just like, I don't know the answer to that. But on the other hand, buses in Ecuador are really good.
Yeah. What I used to do is I would downvote when there were other answers. Like when its ranking was of question, I would tend to downvote to ensure the order stayed right. But the truth is, if I saw someone trying to help and they were the only one, and there were no other answers, I think historically I tend to ignore them, which may not be right. At the end of the day, if you know it's not going to be the right answer, you probably want to ensure it winds up under what is presumed, at least the next answer that comes, we can, on average, assume is more helpful.
So the first thing is we're kind of hoping that you leave it at least. Don't vote up that bad answer, God forbid, because then if you've got something voted up, that's going to knock it out of the unanswered, like the no answers list, right? And that's a bad thing. You've actually harmed the world by voting up something that's not an answer, because you've caused fewer people to see the question.
And you know, as we talk out loud, I think the best response that you definitely should do, so whether you're comfortable downvoting or not, or you should downvote or not, is a more nuanced question.
Yeah.
What you should do almost certainly is add a comment that reflects why you, even if you're not the original asker, writing a comment saying,
thanks for your effort.
Yeah, right. Thanks for trying. You're awesome. I think it seems like you're really trying to help out, but I think the OP was looking for something that specifically spoke to blank.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gives the right commenting is almost certainly the right action to take if you can. The outstanding question is, ought you downvote it versus leaving it alone? And I think
downvote the hell out of that baby.
Would you?
It depends on the answer. Yeah. If it's clearly not a good answer to this question, then downvote it.
I can see leaving it alone
if it's a mediocre workaround, but you're still waiting for the best answer.
Yeah, a workaround that's a real genuine workaround is fine.
Back to the visa question for a second. Yeah. I think if they said, I've never gone into Portugal, but I've traveled to these four places, and in all cases, this would have worked, I'd argue that's not a downvoted answer.
That's dangerous.
Well, but what they're giving you is more information than
I can't tell you how to get to
started with.
Portugal?
Well, but
Brazil is easy.
If it's the only answer, it gives you slightly more information than you had before about that specific situation.
But that might be actually dangerous.
So there's an interesting thing. There's another option here. So he's also asking sort of from the perspective of a moderator, right, who has some additional options available to them. So he actually asks two other things. Should it be converted to a comment, or should it maybe be deleted?
Mm-hmm.
So probably not deletion unless it's actively harming the internet, I would think. But the comment is kind of an interesting place. A comment on the question is an interesting place to kind of add additional information that's not really an answer, right? And you see that a fair amount, right? It's like I can't fully answer this, but I'll give kind of one of the pieces along the way comment.
A comment to the question.
Comment to the question. Yeah.
Which is just sort of like, let me get this down here because this might help somebody build an answer.
Right.
Yeah. Like I don't have time, but check out. Have you checked this source or? Look at this link.
And so that's not a bad option for the person who wants to give a little bit more help, or the moderator who's looking at this, trying to clean it up, maybe convert it to a comment.
All right. I think we're wrapping up. You've been listening to, what was this?
Number 45.
Number 45 what?
This was the podcast
number five.
Oh. Okay. This has been the Stack Exchange podcast.
Your first name is Joel. 45.
You should print this on a little card that I have in front of me at all times. Many thanks to Eric Lippert. Thanks for coming on, Eric.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Eric, where do they find you? Do you have a domain name, a Twitter handle, any of that kind of stuff?
I have a domain, ericlippert.com. That's where I keep my blog nowadays. And I'm on Twitter as well.
And Monads.
He's under at Monads. @ericklippert. You can find him.
If you want to learn about Monads, there's an interesting 5-part series there, which you can read in reverse chronological order. David tried that. It didn't work. His brain blew up. Started by reading part 5 and said he didn't understand.
Then I read it in order and it made plenty of sense.
Oh, did it?
It's actually pretty, it's very readable.
I hit the wall at part 3. but I'm an old man. Don't forget about me. If you want to learn about Monads, it's a great place to go. It's called Fabulous Adventures in Coding, ericlippert.com. Thanks for being on, Eric. Special thanks to David and Jay and Alex who are here every week. And we'll see y'all in 2 weeks' time. How often do we record this? Is this a weekly
every other
podcast?
Week.
Every other week, yeah. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another exciting episode of the Stack Exchange Podcast. That one will be, we're about to move to a new Stack Exchange office.
We are.
No, but not quite. The one in 2 weeks, we might still be here.
Yeah, we'll be here. It's like right before the move.
It's going to be, this place is going to be a trash dump because nobody's going to be cleaning it. They're going to be like, what's the point? We're moving out. Why even bother keeping it clean?
We'll probably just wreck it.
Throwing candy bar wrappers on the floor.
No, but we're running out of candy because our office manager is not reordering any of the candy because why have it shipped here if we just move it? This place is really
because
gonna go
we could run out of candy. Basket.
Exactly. This place is going to go to hell in a handbasket long before. So episode 45. See you next week.
Apparently, Eric Lippert is quite the fan of programmer Ryan Gosling and has even submitted entries to programmer Ryan Gosling.
I submitted one entry to programmer Ryan Gosling after it was brought to my attention that one of the entries on it mentioned me.
It does. It says, I really like how you use the visitor pattern to transform that immutable structure. We should grab some pizza at the .NET user group and talk about Eric Lippert's new blog post about async.
Girl.
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 Hey, girl.